Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Eastern family. Thanks for listening to Eastern Airlines Radio. My name is Neil Holland, the producer of the show. We have a great show for you tonight, but first we have breaking news on this 19th day. Actually, it's not the 19th, it's about the third day of December 2018. Chuck?
Optional warning lights could have aided Lion Air engineers before crash experts. This was from Rutgers, November 29th, by Jamie Friedman and Eric Johnson. An optional warning light could have alerted engineers about the mechanical fault on the Lion Air Boeing 737 MAX jet that crashed last month, experts say. Sparking an industry debate over whether installing the system should become mandatory. Lion Air did not install the AOA disagree alert, which warns pilots when the angle of attack, the AOA speeding, does not match because it's optional. It was optional and not required by regulators. Managing Director Daniel Putman told Rutgers, angle is a key flight parameter which must remain narrow enough to prevent lift and avoid an aerodynamic stall. A faulty AOA reading led the doom of Lion Air jet computer to believe it was installed, prompting the airplane's new anti-stall system called the Maneuvering Characteristic Augmentation System, MCAS for short, to repeatedly push down the nose of the airplane. Barry?
Doomed Lion Air jet was not airworthy, investigators say. By Cindy, Silviana, and Fergus Jensen, November 28, 2018. Jakarta, Reuters. A Lion Air jet that crashed into the sea off Indonesia last month was not in a safe condition on its second-to-last flight when pilots experienced similar problems to those on its doomed last journey, Indonesian investigators said on Wednesday. A preliminary report unveiled fresh details of efforts by pilots to steady the jet as they reported to a quote flight control problem, including the captain's last word to air traffic control asking to be cleared to 5,000 or 5,000 feet. Indonesia's Transport Safety Committee, KNKT, focused on airline maintenance and training and the response of a Boeing anti-stall system to a recently replaced sensor, but did not give a cause for the crash that killed all 189 people on board. At this stage, I do not have the answer, KNKT investigator Nurkayo Utomo told reporters. We'll be bringing you all the latest news on the Lion Air crash as it becomes available to us.
Hello, Eastern family. It's great having you with us. My name is Jim Hart, coming to you live from the beautiful West Palm Beach area, where it's today, would you believe, at a heat wave of 89 degrees. They come down from the cold weather up on Martha's Vineyard, where I was all last summer, and so far along with our other hosts at different locations. We want to welcome and thank you for listening and calling the show. You have truly made us the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We'd love to hear your comments and share your memories with radio listeners from around the world during our broadcast. If you haven't called the show before, all you need to do is to call 213-816-1611 and just say hello to talk with us on the air live. We can identify many countries around the world who listen in with our Blog Talk Radio application. Isn't it great that we can keep the Eastern legacy going out not only to the Eastern family, but to listeners from many different countries around the world? That's what we try to do every week on the EAL radio show. Won't you join us by adding your voice to these broadcasts? Our thanks also to those who choose to listen by computer using the radio icon on our homepage at www.EALradioshow.com, or perhaps by signing in at the site of our provider, Blog Talk Radio, at www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. Should you wish to talk during our live broadcast, feel free to use our call-in number, 213-816-1611, at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Let me repeat that number again, so you can write it down for a Monday night visit. By the way, tell your friends about us too. That number again is 213-816-1611. And don't forget, you can listen to any of our 394 Monday night broadcasts and 75 plus Thursday broadcasts by simply going to blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie and scrolling down through the archives of the many broadcasts there. Each episode is briefly described. Our lines are always open for calls, and if you choose not to participate and talk live with our host, we ask that you please mute your phone, as our producer does not have the capability of filtering out any background noises. Let me ask our host to check in with their name, where they're located right now, where they're calling from, and what the weather is in their backyard today. Who wants to be first?
This is Bill Joseph.
Jim,
okay, let me call him out. As the producer, I want to start with Bill Joseph. Go ahead. You started it. I'll call him out.
I'm up here on the Nature Coast, west coast of Florida, in Pasco County, where the temperature is currently 76 degrees. Possible thunderstorms later tonight.
Okay, let's move over a little bit to the center of the state of Florida, and we have Chuck Albright. Chuck, check in with us.
I'm in a place called the Stitches, a large retirement center. We have quite a few golf courses, 53 to be exact. Today was at 80. We're having a heat wave here today. It did rain a little bit on the golf course, but we kind of muddled through. And it's going to be a beautiful evening.
Okay,
thank
I'm going to move up to Atlanta, where we have two of our hosts, husband and wife team. Let's go with the wife first, Carrie Holder. Carrie, how are you?
Okay, this is Carrie Holder. I'm in Conyers, Georgia, and it's partly cloudy here and not near as cold as it was the other night.
Okay, I guess you can pass the phone to Jim Holder. Jim, how are you?
He's 50 feet away.
Yeah, I'm at the other end of the house, and it's a beautiful day in Conyers, Georgia.
Very good. Let's see if I can remember now. Moving on up, we've got up in New York area, we've got Mike Scott. Mike, how are you?
Yeah, I'm on here, and it's Smithtown, New York, and it was a nice day today. Sun was shining. It was a little over 50 degrees, and it's supposed to be getting on a cooling trend for the next 3 or 4 days, but it was a very nice day today.
Okay, real close by, George Chen. George, are you with us? Nope. Okay, well, maybe you'll check in just a little bit. And or maybe I didn't turn his microphone on. We'll find out one way or the other. But let's see. Let's go to over in Ridgefield, Connecticut, and that would be Dick Aarons. Dick, how are you tonight?
I'm well, and good evening, everybody at Eastern. Today it's been unusually warm for New England. We've been in a cold spell, but it got up into the 50s today. Little dreary overcast, but other than that, a nice day.
Very good. And Shay Oakley, you are in New Jersey somewhere, Shay?
Yes, sir. Freehold, New Jersey, in Monmouth County, and it was 55 here today, which is a heat wave for December.
Okay. And we've got a very special guest with us tonight. And I want to just say, Emil, if you would say hello right now, and we've got more to talk to you about later on in the show. Emil Greenway. Emil, welcome. Well,
listening tonight, those that aren't. The temperature here right now is 71 degrees, and it's partly cloudy. Today we had a temperature up into the 80s. And I'm living in a place called Buckingham Air Park. It's in just outside of Fort Myers, and I have my own hangar. That's where I'm talking from now, but there's no airplane in it.
Good. Okay. Thanks so much, Emil. We'll be back with you. Jim Hart, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
All right. Now, Mr. Producer, I see we are number one for takeoff. So let's get flight episode 393 in the air as soon as you can.
December the 4th, 1965, between the Eastern Airlines Constellation, Flight 853, and TWA Boeing 707 Flight 42, and the miraculous landing made by the Eastern crew. Also, the heroism of Captain Charles White of Eastern Airlines. All information for this article was taken from newspaper reports, the CAB accident report, and a story that was written in Reader's Digest entitled 10 Minutes to Live by Warren R. Young. The aircraft appeared to be converging at the same altitude as Eastern 853. First Officer Roger Holt immediately exclaimed, "Look out," and placed his hands on the control yoke and made a very rapid application of up elevator simultaneously with Captain White.
"Watch out!"
Flight Engineer Greenway, facing the engineer's panel, saw four red lights flash on. Plane's hydraulic pressure had dropped, indicating that they were losing hydraulic pressure. Engineer Greenway called out,
"Pressure and quantity, pressure and quantity."
Captain White reached out and pulled the hydraulic boost levers, the link between the control column and the control surfaces on the wing and tail. Normally, the aircraft could be flown via the fixed control cables, but they also were severed and failed to respond to the flight crew's inputs. The aircraft shuddered and then began a diving left turn. The airspeed at times went above the normal operating speed. 2 minutes after the collision, Engineer Greenway called New York ATC.
"Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is Eastern 853. We have had a mid-air collision and are in trouble. We're out of control. We're in a dive now, climbing now. We're descending. We're at 7,000 feet. Give us a vector to Kennedy." A heading was given.
"Negative, negative, New York. We can't make it. We'll just do the best we can. Keep an eye on us, please, and see where we're going to wind up."
While diving, the crew could not regain control of the aircraft. There was no response from the controls or trim tabs. The only way they regained control was with power applications of the throttle. The aircraft began to zoom up and down several times into the clouds. Finally, after expert maneuvering of the throttles, a setting was found which would maintain a descent and level attitude with some degree of consistency. Passing over the Danbury Airport at 2,000 to 3,000 feet, which was too high for them to make an approach, they could only maintain speed of between 125 and 140 knots the whole time the aircraft's nose would rise when power was applied and fall off when power was removed. Amongst all the stress and dealing with the emergency, Captain White was able to make an announcement to the 49 passengers. Captain White and the crew knew it was apparent that the flight could not be maintained, and a decision was made to effect a landing in an open field.
"This is the captain. We've hit another airplane, but we're still in control. I'll be back with you."
And now returning to his crew.
"Looks like we got three options the way I see it. We can go straight ahead to that hill over there with a few trees. Maybe try to veer to the right and land in that lake. Or turn left and keep searching for a few more seconds."
"I don't much care for the lake. I don't think we very many would get out of here alive."
The crew could see the steep hill and were deeply concerned about the hazard of trying to put the aircraft down there. Captain White spotted a small pasture on the side of the hill called Hunt's Mountain. He looked over at his co-pilot and said,
"How about that little field over there?
Hey, let's go do it."
As the light was fading on this late afternoon December day, Captain White scanned the area, making his approach while manipulating the throttle. He spoke to the passengers one more time.
"Brake yourself. Here it comes."
Excerpts from the article, 10 Minutes to Live by Warren R. Young. The field was clear of animals, but three boys were walking across it. The oldest boy, Danny Williamson, yelled at his brother and their friend to jump over a stone wall edging the field. There was no time to run farther, and they crouched there as the big ship rushed right toward them. In the field stood two houses and a large barn with a concrete silo. To use all the field for his landing, Captain White had to coax his plane down almost to roof level and fly between the buildings. In the barn were 20 saddle horses, two horsewomen, a groom, and 14-year-old Jeffrey Von Kuhn, an after-school stable boy.
To make the crash resemble a landing, Captain White had to make the plane perform one more last maneuver, the most critical of all. He could see as they closed in through the dust that because of the slope of the hill, they would bore nose first into the earth if nothing was done. All of his pilot training teaches him when landing a normal airplane to pull back on the control yoke and reduce the power so the aircraft would settle gently to earth. But with no flight controls, Captain White would have to put the power on again to lift the nose. If he did it a second or two soon, the plane would zoom up, miss the field, stall, and drop in a flaming heap. If he did it a second too late, the nose would not lift in time, and the plane would smash harder, nose first, into the ground. Co-pilot Hope saw the need, too, and he reached out to shove the throttle, but the captain's hand, already there, had chosen the moment. White revved all the engines to full power in an instant, and priceless needed to re-tilt the nose up before impact. Quote, just that final maneuver alone senses when to pull on the power, says Gary Holt, Roger's brother, and himself a Constellation pilot for Eastern. It has to be to call one of the most magnificent feats of airmanship in the history of flying.
Stewardess Kathy DePue kept trying to walk down the aisle to help a woman passenger out, but her efforts seemed to be turning into a slow motion. Crying for help, she turned over the job of helping the woman to some men and staggered out upon the hill where one of the soldiers carried her safety. She had a crushed spinal disc that would have to be removed. The other stewardess, Patricia Scarada, had just leapt out the open fuselage when she heard a young woman moaning and saw her still in the wreckage. Pat took the baby from her and led her out of the plane. Then she hurried back in to help other passengers. Later, she saw Kathy DePue lying on the ground where the soldier had placed her. Pat bent over to see how badly Kathy was hurt, then found that she could not straighten up. She had 5 broken bones in her back. A soldier, Private Dennis Fluker, was in trouble. His buddies tried to help him unfasten his jammed seatbelt without success. Finally, the heat of the flames drove them to make their own escape. Along with the passengers, ambulances carried away the co-pilot and flight engineer. Emil Greenway was able to walk, and he was found sitting near the stone wall with a bad gash across his ear and head. His left hand was cut, probably by the electrical switches he flicked off at the last moment. But he was in shock. His memory of all the events from the final approach onward was wiped out, and in fact, he would remember nothing that happened during the next 2 days. Apparently, he left the cockpit through a crew door beside his position. Co-pilot Holt was more badly hurt, and his escape from the plane had been difficult. Holt crawled or fell out of the small sliding window on the left side of the cockpit, the captain's side, and then collapsed in a heap.
Neither Holt or Greenway has ever been able to recall whether they got out by themselves or were helped by the captain. And to this day, nobody can say for certain just what happened to Captain Charles White. It seems clear that immediately after the crash, there were no serious injuries to him. He had brought his stricken aircraft down by means of superb talent and unshakable nerve. There is little doubt that Charles White could have walked out of the wreckage to join the living and enjoy the acclaimed action that he had earned. But the rule of air travel, as it is at sea, the captain is the last to leave the ship. His younger brother, Lou, remembers a time when Chuck White confided in his own concept of duty during his Air Force days. A news report story about a bomber crash in which the pilot parachuted to safety, but all other crew members went down to the plane. Quote, if a plane of mine ever goes down, Chuck said, even the dead men are going out with parachutes before I do, end quote. His words were more than prophetic.
One thing is certain. Captain White was later found not in the cockpit, but back in the passenger cabin. All the available evidence shows that, alone in the cockpit and with two open ways to get out, he faced up to his final duty just 9.5 minutes after the mid-air collision as the oxygen bottles blew up and the flames and smoke billowed ever more fiercely throughout the plane. He walked back to try to save the last passengers. There are faint clues that he succeeded in unfastening Private Fluker's seatbelt and then turned to lead the way out. Quote, in my personal opinion, says safety investigator Jack Carroll, who arrived on the scene that night to study the accident with CAB, there is little doubt that Captain White had deliberately gone back to the cabin to help the young soldier. There, perhaps 30 seconds later, along with Captain of Private Fluker, Captain Chuck died, overcome by the poisonous fumes emitted by the fire.
We have two very important guests with us tonight. I'm honored to present our first guest, the second officer on Flight 853, Captain Emil Greenway. Emil, would you say hello just for now? I know you've said it before, but say it again, and we'll get back with you a little bit later.
Okay. Hello, Eastern Airlines listeners and hosts. It's great being with you this evening.
Thanks so much, Emil. Hello, Eastern Airlines listeners. Okay, you've got it. Our second guest is Mr. Dick Aaron, aviation safety writer and pilot and safety editor, the Business and Commercial Aviation magazine. Dick is semi-retired from a writing career that began as a crime reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News and United Press International, then moved through all editorial positions at Business and Commercial Aviation, a technical magazine for airline and corporate turbine aircraft flight crews. He specialized there in avionics, aircraft systems, and accident investigation. He holds a commercial pilot's license with type ratings in Cessna Citation and Falcon 900 series jets. He is trained in aircraft and marine accident investigation and fire arson investigation. Currently, he writes a monthly column on aircraft accident analysis that appears in Business and Commercial Aviation and Aviation Week online. He also holds an FAA Part 107 UAS Remote Operator Certificate. Dick has served as Ridgefield, Connecticut's Deputy Emergency Manager for 8 years and is responsible for coordination of the town's Emergency Operations Center during major natural and man-made emergencies and disasters. Currently, he is the chair of the Ridgefield Public Safety Communications Task Force, a group that manages fire, police, and emergency radio systems. He's a crime scene photographer for the Reading Police Department and a photography consultant to the Ridgefield Police Department. The Connecticut Police Officer Standardization and Training Council is certified Dick as a police photographer instructor, currently teaching the use of UAS in public safety and law enforcement applications. Dick is a member of the International Association of Air Safety Investigators and the Airborne Public Safety Association. Dick and Dee Aarons moved to Ridgefield in 1974 with daughter Noel and son Mike. Noel is a human resources manager for a New England power company, and Mike flies Boeing 767s for Atlas Air. Dick? I'm going to ask Dick to repeat that again because I had a little technical error there. Dick, welcome to our show tonight.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me, and it's great to be with you on the occasion of the 53rd anniversary of Eastern Flight 853.
Dick, I'm going to ask you as an editorial writer to read this tribute written by an Eastern captain and editor of the retired Eastern Pilots Association magazine, Repartee, Captain Bill Malone. The title is An Act of Heroism. Dick, would you please?
Thank you, Neil. It's an honor. As one travels up Main Street in Ridgefield, Connecticut, to take Route 116 into North Salem, New York, one comes upon the little road of Hunt's Lane leading to Hunt's Mountain. This tranquil scene gives no hint of the powerful drama that was taking place in the sky above on December 4, 1965, or the sad ending that it would follow. Suddenly, and without warning, Eastern's Captain Charles White, flying Shuttle Flight 853, found himself without the use of normal controls in his Constellation after suffering a mid-air collision with a Boeing 707. As the other ship blimped on to Idlewild Airport with 25 feet of its left wing sheared off, Chuck White and his crew discovered the collision had disabled their ship's hydraulic system. Manual reversion in the Constellation has been compared with attempting to steer while holding on to the horns of a bull, and even some of this control was lost as a result of the collision. As the big ship veered off course, Captain Chuck White and his crew, Roger Holt and Darrell Greenway, were able to level off by alternating the power on the four engines. While experimenting with this limited control, he made an announcement to his passengers to calm and reassure them. The sun was setting, and an immediate decision of where to land was urgent. Born in Brooklyn, New York, Captain Charles J. White attended 2 years at Boise Junior College in Boise, Idaho, before joining the Air Corps at the outbreak of World War II. He became both an instructor and bomber pilot, flying missions from England in B-24s with the 8th Air Force. After the war, he took part in the Berlin airlift, carrying supplies to Soviet bloc Berlin. His military career brought him the Air Medal and 2 Distinguished Flying Crosses. Now in the twilight, he was to call upon all of his past experience to meet the crisis that confronted him, his crew, and his passengers. An open area on the slope of Hunt's Mountain was located, and the decision to attempt a landing at that location was made. Power was reduced and glide slope established. Then, with a burst of power on all four engines, they were able to raise the nose and break the glide. The airplane touched down and began to slide up the hill. As the plane shed its wings, the fuselage split open, and almost all of the passengers and crew were able to escape. Captain Joe Hackard of Eastern Airlines was in his yard at Ridgefield, Connecticut, raking leaves when he heard the Constellation pass overhead and then crash on the side of Hunt's Mountain. He hurried to the scene. Many of the local residents, the Croton Falls Fire Department, the town police, ambulance services, physicians, clergy, and emergency services of the surrounding municipalities had rushed to the rescue. Unable to account for all the passengers, Captain White rushed back into the wreckage and located a soldier still strapped to his seat. In his attempt to rescue the U.S. Army private, both were overcome by smoke. Leaking fuel ignited, and both were killed, along with 2 other passengers. All others made it to safety. Captain Charles J. White was buried in Arlington National Cemetery with military honors, and his funeral was attended by a delegation of Eastern Airlines pilots who served as pallbearers. A bronze plaque was unveiled at a dedication ceremony on the tranquil hillside at the foot of Hunt's Mountain where the event occurred. Attending were Captain Joe Hackett, Captain Helmut Heitz, Captain Don Cockert, and Captain Stan Bator, along with members of the North Salem American Legion Post and the local residents. The act of heroism performed by Captain Chuck White will not be forgotten.
Now, Dick, I know on that day you too were called to work, and anything you'd like to add to this in your own words as to the scene and doing what you were asked to do in your line of work, Dick?
Yes, Neil, thank you. I returned to the crash site just 2 days ago. It's located at the Horse River Farm in North Salem, about 300 yards from the Ridgefield town line. The hillside is covered by picket fence paddocks and open meadows, those surrounded by ancient stone walls. It's a peaceful place and really quite beautiful. The bronze plaque is aging, but it's still easily read. It is dedicated to Captain White, the three passengers lost, and the citizens of North Salem and surrounding communities who provided aid to the 49 survivors. The last line on the plaque asks that God have mercy on their departed souls and provide grace to all those who assisted. My first visit, of course, was back in 1965, about midday on December 5. Local authorities were keeping the curious behind a stone wall along Hunt's Lane. The conning lay broken in three pieces. The engine had separated, and much of the fuselage sections had burned away. The earth surrounded the wreckage had been blackened by the extinguished fuel fire. Two trees downslope had been broken about 50 feet above the ground. The left wing was nearby, showing fire damage. It had sheared at impact with the trees. The right wing had separated too as the aircraft slid up the slope, but oddly had not burned and still contained some fuel. CAB investigators were beginning to survey the scene, looking for the four corners, and we were getting reports that residents about 4 miles southwest of the site near Carmel Vortac were finding debris from both airplanes in their yards and woodlots. The debris recovery would take several days and ultimately would provide evidence of the attitude in airplanes in the final seconds before impact. As a new pilot working toward my commercial ticket in hopes of an airline career, I really couldn't believe that a crew was able essentially to land an airliner on that hillside without totally destroying the aircraft and its occupants at touchdown. Frankly, I believe then and now that a Cessna 172 pilot would have trouble landing on that slope with all controls working without sustaining some serious damage. Later, when I learned that Captain White and his crew had maneuvered the Connie using engine power alone to keep the airplane flying, and then to approach and flare into a 15% grade, I was astonished. In my judgment, that crew's accomplishment was one of the greatest feats of airmanship in the history of commercial aviation, and remains so until today. Personally, Flight 853 incident was to play a major role in setting me on the road to a career that is focused on aviation safety from that day forward. As it turned out, an inner ear problem kept me from an airline career, but I loved flying and was fascinated by the industry's focus on learning from accidents to prevent future loss of life. Ultimately, I was able to combine my writing and aviation experiences and join the editorial staff of BCA. Over the years, I've concentrated on spreading the lessons learned from accident investigations to the professional pilot community. As a side note, my wife Dee and I eventually moved to Ridgefield, where we have lived for the last 40 years. Last Saturday was the first time I returned to the crash scene since that chilly day in 1965.
Thank you so much, Dick. Very interesting. And I'd like to also ask Shay Oakley. I believe, Shay, you found something that you'd like to share with us. Shay, are you with us?
Yes, just a short bio and tribute to Captain White. Captain Charles J. White was the son of a New York City detective, born and raised in Brooklyn. At the age of 19, Charlie White was one of the youngest bomber captains in the Air Force during World War II. In 1948, he voluntarily left his job at Eastern to fly the Berlin Airlift, and he earned a college degree by going to night school while flying for the airline, two indications of his determination and his sense of duty. White was to display both qualities again on this day of December 4th, 1965, plus raw courage. And that's from the book Loud and Clear by Robert J. Serling.
Thank you, Shay. Thank you, Dick. Very good accounts for accounting of your work. Dick, was this an article that you had written that appeared in one of the magazines? Because I believe Reader's Digest, we're going to ask Emil a little bit more about this, but did you have this article appearing in one of the magazines or just your
Yes, on a couple occasions. I write a column called Cause and Circumstance and have since the mid-'80s. And in that column, this is one of the accidents we discussed primarily because of the phenomenon of visual illusions. As you know, the central problem with the crew of the Eastern Airlines flight was that they were looking into an upsloping cloud deck, which created an illusion that they were at the same altitude and on a collision course with TWA. And the Eastern flight actually pulled up to avoid a collision, and both airplanes ended up at 11,000 feet simultaneously. Boeing did a great deal of research back in the day on visual illusions, so this accident became one of those that was really a lesson for the community that the world is sometimes not what it seems when you look out the window.
Thank you, Dick. And now, just sitting here listening to all of this, we have our guest of honor, Captain Emil Greenway. And as we I should tell you, he was hired in 1964 as an Eastern pilot and the second officer on Flight 853. Welcome, Emil. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me, Neil.
Well, would you like to say something at the beginning of this, of what you thought of what has been presented? Because we're going to open up all the microphones, and believe me, Emil, every slot on my 25 position board here is open. We've got callers. So would you like to tell us where you're living and so forth? Appreciate it.
Well, yes, I'd like to make a comment. Everything that I've heard so far is factually true. And what bothers me, I finished my career in 1989, I was a captain on a DC-9 flying out of Miami. And since I retired in 1989, I have a cousin who flies for United Airlines. And so I get, and I also get the ALPA magazine and stuff. And I see where the FAA has tightened up the airspace, which when I was flying, any altitude above 29,000, it was 2,000 feet separation. We went, to, you know, up to 31,000, 33, 35, 37, so forth. Today they've tightened that up, so you now have aircraft that are only separated by 1,000 feet. And I think back to what happened to us with the illusion of the clouds and stuff, and I think, you know, we're setting ourselves up for something like this possibly in the future again, because you know, at that altitude, you have not a whole lot of reference to, you know, altitude and so forth. So I don't know. Of course, they have better instruments today and better altimeters, and everything is much better. So that's the only comment I have to make on what I've heard so far.
Well, Emil, you and I chatted before the show and a couple of days prior to when I asked you if you would be with us on the show tonight, and you mentioned the fact that you do recall certain things, and you recall sitting on a fence. It was an interesting story. Would you share that with us on that rock fence?
I don't remember much. In fact, I don't remember anything really at impact. Prior to impact, I got out of my seat and I saw the lake that they were discussing, and we turned and we got lined up to try to make this farm area. I got back in my seat and fastened my seatbelt, and then after that, I don't remember much because we did hit. And the first officer's seat, and for those who don't know what a first officer is, that's the co-pilot. The co-pilot seat on the back of the Connie has got some metal bars that support the back of the seat. And when on impact, my head hit that bar, and I guess it knocked me out. I had my ear half torn off, and I was, if I was awake after that, I was probably in shock because I don't remember getting out of the airplane. But I had a fade in. In other words, I kind of it kind of the memory kind of opened up a little bit for me to know that I was sitting on a fence. Now, I was wearing my coat at the time of the accident. What I was probably the last person in the seat when we left Boston. And as an engineer, I would be the one pre-flighting the airplane and outside, and it was rather chilly that evening or that afternoon. And so I had my coat on, and when I got out of the airplane, the first thing that people spotted was a crew member in uniform, and they mistook me for Chuck White. And so the original word out was that the captain survived, but the second officer didn't. Well, it was only because I was wearing my coat with stripes on it, and people don't realize how many stripes make a captain, which are four. And anyway, I went over. I guess I got to this stone fence, and I sat on it, and there was a lady sitting on the fence also. And I looked over at her, and I remember asking her, "Are you okay?" And she says, "I'm freezing." And I took my coat off and gave it to her. And that's all I remember at that point until I finally came to a couple of days later in the hospital.
Well, Emil, I'd like to open it up now to our host, guests, and listeners to ask you questions they must have about Eastern Flight 853. And I've got all the mics open now. And one at a time, please. Anyone wants to be first, go right ahead.
Captain Greenway, I have a question for you. This is Shea Oakley. I was reading in the book about this incident that you actually had a small private aircraft with an instructor and student pilot that was following you, knowing they couldn't do anything but unwilling to leave you. And they said that as the Connie neared the hill and the men in the small plane saw its red anti-collision light suddenly blink off, Greenway had cut off all electric circuits. Do you remember that? Or is that
no,
awful look?
I don't remember that. I know the only thing that I remember is that when we were in the gyrations, you know, losing altitude, gaining altitude, and Captain White was operating the throttles, here I am as an engineer, thinking like an engineer, and I'm thinking he's going to overboost these engines. And so I tried to preserve the engine, so I ran the RPM up. We were cruising, I think, at about 2,100 RPM on all four engines. And we had a single lever to the left of the throttles that you could actually change the props, the RPMs, changing the pitch on the propellers with the constant speed props. I could change all four pitches with one lever. It was a little handle stuck up. And I got a hold of that lever, and I brought the throttles up to, or the lever up to, or the props up to 2,600 RPM, which was MITO power. That was maximum accept takeoff power. And so I brought the RPM up to 2,600. And it was kind of funny because at the hearing with the CAB, I mentioned that fact to them, and they said, "Yes, we know, because we checked the governors on the props, and they were set at 2,600. So that I know it wasn't a dream. You know, I actually did that because I had mentioned that, and then they reinforced the fact that I did by what they found with the governors on the props. But as far as shutting the switches off, if I did, I don't remember. I don't remember that at all, but I don't know what I did at that point because it's, you know, everything's just, you know, no memory of it, but I do remember what happened prior to the impact.
Thank you, sir.
I'm going to ask Emil, what are you doing now in retirement, Emil? And,
well,
do you have an airplane?
Well, I did buy an airplane. I did one of the dumb things that pilots do. I bought an airplane, And after realizing that nobody was buying the fuel for it or paying the insurance on it and paying the repairs on it, I said, what in the world did I do this for? Because where am I going to go? So most of our neighbors in Buckingham Air Park, every Wednesday and Saturdays, they all fly to breakfast. So they get together and fly to breakfast. And one time they all flew to Branson, Missouri, to see some shows up there. So it's an active air park that I'm in. And it was a lot of fun, but the expense of it and being on retirement, I just couldn't afford to keep that Mooney up. It was a Mooney aircraft, retractable gear, constant speed prop. A rather nice airplane, but too expensive for me. And but other than that, I have a big empty hangar here, and so my wife comes up with projects for me. So I'm constantly making something for her, and I do a lot of woodworking. I've made a desk, an entertainment center, and I do this with, you know, woodworking. With I got a table saw, a router, and a planer, and so I got almost a small machine shop in my hangar because my father. Before I started my career with Eastern, I got out of high school. My father owned a machine shop in down near Hialeah, Florida, and I was sweat labor for him. I went down there and I worked in that shop, and I didn't like that work. So, and then later I went into the Air Force. But going around here, there's not really for me too much to do except maybe puttering in my shop.
How long were you off before? Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, Emil. This is Jim Holder. Two things. One, the next morning, I too was flying the shuttle. I too was a flight engineer, and I too flew the boat shuttle that morning, the next day. And the captain, I forgot, this was on an Electra, though it wasn't on a Connie. And we obviously knew about the crash, and the captain, it was BFR. And he knew where to go to find the Hunts Mountain. And we circled overhead probably at about 2,000 feet or something like that and saw what had happened. And it's impossible. My memory is such that the plane looked like it took up the whole little pasture. From the air, just no way anybody could live through that. And yet we knew that a lot of people had. And it was an amazing, amazing piece of airmanship. I got a question for you, though. Had you flown with Chuck White before? Were you on a line with him, or was this just something you on reserve of what? Had you flown with Chuck before?
Oh yeah, I knew Chuck very well. We socialized a little bit after flights, you know, and yeah, I flew many trips with Chuck, and he was one phenomenal person. And what I observed in the cockpit of that airplane. I saw no panic. Everybody was calm. And I guess I got a little bit excited because I'm the one that called New York Center. Because earlier, about 11 months prior to that, I had been dating a flight attendant. Her name was Linda Lord. And she was on a flight out of Kennedy Airport on a DC-7 that had a near miss, and they lost control of the DC-7 and crashed off of Jones Beach, and she was killed. And there wasn't a peep out of the airplane. And I said that if I were ever to get into a situation where we have a midair or somebody blows the plane up, as long as I can get on that mic, I'm going to tell somebody what happened. So, because in those days, we didn't have voice recorders. We didn't have flight data recorders. We didn't have all this stuff on. Now, the jets had them, but the prop airplanes didn't have them in 1965. So we didn't have all of this equipment, and it was up to me. I thought at that point they were busy flying the airplane. I had to tell them what happened. We had a midair collision. You know, we're going down, you know. And I wanted them to know what happened because the actual impact was very mild as far as feeling anything. It felt like the landing gear went out. The bump you get when the landing gear comes down or when it comes up, the airplane just bounces a little. I recently flew on a new 737, and I was telling my wife, I said, now they're going to put the gear down, and you're going to feel the bump. Well, I felt no bump. And when we took off, I didn't feel any bump. So these new airplanes don't that weren't as antiquated as what we were flying back in 1965 when you think of all the equipment that they have today.
I got another question for you, if I might. During the hearing and all of that, did you have any interaction with the TWA crew?
No, I never spoke to anybody at the time, but the only thing that we had an attorney, I guess, and he came and talked to Roger and I both and told us how to conduct ourselves at the hearing. And one of the things he told me was be specific about when they give you a question, don't elaborate. Just answer the question and then shut up. And I did that during the interview, and I almost started laughing because it was kind of funny because the attorney was trying to get me to open my mouth and say more, and I wouldn't. But anyway, it was how the CAB and the rest of them work. They spend months, years trying to figure out what happened, then they expect us to make a decision in a split second. And from the time Roger spotted that airplane until we hit, I think it was just milliseconds. I mean, it just it happened real quick. And you take two aircraft coming together, and I think our at that time, my log shows that we were at 210 knots in cruise at 10,000 feet. That was indicated airspeed. And the jet, I imagine he was somewhere above that. So we have a closure rate of about 500 knots. You're moving pretty quick.
So you didn't talk to any of the TWA guys at the hearing or anything?
No, I had no contact with them. I didn't even see them. I'm not even sure they were even in the room. They might have been. There was a lot of people in that room, and I don't know. Like I said, I was just kind of, just trying to get my thoughts together for the hearing.
Mm-hmm.
How long had you been on the Connie,
Amel?
How long had you been flying it?
The Connie? I was hired January the 27th in 1964. And what happened was Eastern had been through a strike a little bit earlier before I came, and they had a group of pilots they called the 272 group who were taken out of the right seat, and they were training these fellas to fly engineer because, according to the contract, they couldn't hire engineers to replace the striking engineers. So what they did was they hired me as a pilot, but then to be an engineer, but I didn't know that at the time. And so I flew a DC-7 as a first officer on that for about 2 months, 3 months. And then I got word that I had to go to New York. I was based in Boston at the time. And I had to go to New York to go through training for flight engineers. So I ended up in New York for 6-8 weeks while I got my flight engineer's rating and everything. So I would say by the mid-summer of 1964, I was probably on the line flying as a Connie. So this accident happened probably about 14, maybe 15 months after I had checked out on the airplane.
And I believe you told me the other night that you never flew the Connie again. That was your last flight.
Well, that was. That was my last flight, and I suppose after I got out of the hospital, I was in a hospital for about 2 or 3 weeks. They fitted a brace on me because of I had a jammed vertebrae where I was sitting. I guess the aircraft came down pretty hard on the nose, and when it did, it jolted. It turned a square vertebrae into a triangular shaped one without the apex. I mean, it was just a triangle, but not a complete triangle. It was just in the shape of a triangle in my spine. And the doctors at the time said that when I got old, I would be getting arthritis in it. Well, that didn't happen. I'm 80 years old now, and I don't have any back problems. But at the time, I was in a brace, and I tell you the truth, it was trying to get my head straight because that was a terrifying experience that I went through at that time, and I was only 27 years old at the time. So I went home and I recuperated at my parents' house, and then I guess about June of, I guess this was 1966, I got checked out. We had a bid out, and I got checked out on a Convair 440, and then I started flying first officer on that. So I never went back to the Connie.
Did you keep track of your first? Can you think of his name now? Your first officer, Roger.
Oh, Roger Holt.
Roger Holt.
No, yeah. the last time I saw Roger was I walked into his room in a hospital, and boy, did he look bad. His whole head was bandaged up, and his face was black. I mean, it was just black and blue. I mean, he was, it didn't look like Roger, to tell you the truth. And that's the last time I saw Roger, and I had heard, by rumor, I'm not sure it's true or not, but I had heard from some other pilots that he never came back to work. He quit and went to work for his father, who was flying on flying float planes up in northern, I guess it was Maine. They had a camp up there, and they would fly people into the different lakes up there to go fishing. And that's what he was doing. That's what I had heard. Now, whether it's true or not, he had a brother, Gary Holt, which I also knew at the time, and I never saw him again either later, because I never came back to Boston. And the next time I came back to Boston, I was a captain flying a DC-9, and that was, oh, probably 8-10 years later. It's hard for me to give a couple-word answer, isn't it, Neil?
No. You're done.
I believe, this is Mike here, Captain. I believe that he was flying one of the only DC-3s that was on float up there, on floats up there in Maine at one time. That was what I had heard.
Yeah,
but that's the only thing I had ever heard about him.
Yeah, like I said, I just heard it, through the grapevine. Eastern was a great place for, communication. They used to say telephone, telegraph, and telewoman was the three quickest ways of communication. But I tell you, if anything that went out of your mouth at Eastern, it was all over.
I recall they made a medallion. Didn't they have it in the main office in Miami, there on Lejeune Road, Building 16?
They had one for Hartley.
Yeah.
But in the training center, now I was, when I checked out as captain, I had flown the DC-9 for, 10 years, and then I went to the L-1011, flew it, and then I got called back to fly the DC-9, and my time came up in Miami, and after I finished up my training in Miami on a DC-9, the FAA inspector that checked me out went in and spoke to the vice president of the light aircraft, which was the DC-9 and 727, Burt Beach. And he was so impressed with my performance in the simulator on a check ride that Burt Beach asked me to come in the office and instruct. So I flew the line for about a year, and then I went into the office, and I was an instructor on a DC-9 at the training center. But the only plaque there was the Hartley plaque that I know of.
Neil, this is
yes,
Jay Oakley. Could I just speak to that for a second? The plaque?
Please.
As a boy flying, by the way, Captain Greenway, I'm the honorary Eastern passenger who's part of the show. But growing up and as a boy flying out of your terminal at JFK, I remember exploring and discovering a plaque. It showed a sideways bust of Captain White's head, and it had text underneath it about the accident and his heroism. And that terminal was knocked down in 1994. And I was curious as to what had happened to the plaque. I spoke with a gentleman named Bill Hirsch. Neil, you may know him.
Yeah, I do.
Yes.
He's active in Eastern historical preservation efforts. He said that it ended
Bill.
Up... I think Bill said that it was saved, and it might have ended up with the University of Miami collection. I'm not certain about that.
Uh-huh.
But it certainly existed. It hung there for many, many years.
Yeah, I never saw it, but I also, there's a plaque hanging in Atlanta of all the retired Eastern pilots, and I haven't seen that either, and I've been told that it's still there in Atlanta at Hartsville.
I've seen that recently.
Yeah, Jim Holder could talk about that.
Gary Frost and I and others were involved in getting the one of all the names put up. And Jerry, are you still on the radio here? I guess
Jerry Frost, are you with us?
No, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
I was just.
Yeah, go ahead.
We were talking about the plaque at Atlanta, Jerry.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the plaque's there. In fact, we just gave the airport our new addendum plaque of an additional 255 names that are waiting to be installed along with the two large plaques there. But if you're ever through Atlanta, go to the North Terminal, and it's a little annex walkthrough. And you'll see our huge display of those two large plaques. There's over, 6,600 names. We tried to get all of the Eastern pilots that ever flew with Eastern. Of course, we know we couldn't get them all, but we got as many as we could. But the plaques are there permanently.
Could you give
us
a real quick...
photographs of Eastern airplanes, too.
Yeah, could you give us a real quick, I don't know, Jerry or Jim, history of that? Because I don't think Dick Ahrens, I think since you haven't seen it, Emil, it started by when a pilot died. I think every year you added to that, didn't you? Is that how it started?
That's correct. It started out as in Miami, and then the little plaque had moved to Atlanta, and it buried quickly was filled up, so they came up with two much larger plaques, and then they eventually filled up, and we had we couldn't add another one, so Jerry and I, Sandy McCullough, and Bob Drowdy, basically we took down the old ones, made this long list of 6,700 pilots, and Jerry contacted a Barnes company, U.S. Barnes, I think, up in New York, and they made these plaques for us, and the unique thing is that REPA, we had no idea what it was going to cost, and we said we might be bankrupt in REPA, but we signed all the contracts to do this, and we found out that the plaques were going to be, $22,000, if I remember correctly, and so we started a campaign to raise money, and we ended up with, $45,000, and that's obviously it didn't bankrupt REPA. And we were able to put up the addendum that Jerry talks about. And actually, anybody can go online and see it and zoom in on this Giga thing that Jerry's got. And you can zoom in and see individual names on the computer. Now, I can't tell you how to do that because I don't know.
Emil,
but Jerry Frost does.
Emil, go to easternpilots.com. And that's the website where the plaques are, a photograph of the plaques. It's a large, very large size file so that, as Jim said, you can zoom in on any name. Just follow the prompt. You can go to full screen. Use your mouse. You can scroll in and out. And you can see dust spots on those plaques. The quality's so good. And you'll also see your name. Captain White's and your first officer will be there too. But those names that we've been assured by Hartsfield that those plaques will remain there as long as we'll be around.
Yeah. Well, I'm surprised that I'll be able to see my name on a plaque while I'm still alive.
Yeah.
Well, that was the purpose.
Many people can see their name on a plaque and be alive.
Right. Well, what happened, as Jim described it originally, as pilots would pass away, we would cast bronze plates of the names of those that did pass away for the year. Well, we ran out of space, and so it's obvious that Eastern's no longer here, that And who's going to be the last man to be on that plaque, that we might as well just find as many names as we can and put us all on it, which we did.
And I gotta add, too, for the listeners, that the idea of putting everybody's name up was Jerry Frost. He came up with that idea, and
well,
it was a good one.
I can tell you, last time I went through Atlanta, display is prominent. It's not easy to miss. I mean, it's right out there. A lot of people
it's
see
on
it.
The North Terminal, just you come in, I think, gate number N5. Is that not right, Jerry? And you go straight ahead
and be on the wall on your right. Right.
Yeah.
It's N5. And you'll see the little walkway, and we actually own that walkway, at least one side of the wall.
And they wouldn't let us do anything except after 10 o'clock at night. And and that was all done after 10 o'clock at night. And we got to give them a lot of credit. They helped us for years and years and years doing this. And then, but when we had the dedication, which was December about 5 years ago, I think, they got out a PA system for us, and they bought out the people restrainers, and we had the dedication there, and all the pastors were joining in on us doing it. Well, I think we got all the way from the TWA Eastern crash. I'm sorry if I did that.
But if you remember, we were very competitive with Delta. It was always a game with us and Delta, so I'm surprised Delta allowed that to happen there in their home base.
Yeah, well, don't forget that one time we were larger than Delta there in Atlanta, and we were the first ones there, too. And
that's right.
As I understand, we were the first ones to taxi into the new terminal when they opened it up, too.
Yeah.
Dick Bistol was the captain.
Yeah, well, the old saying was, they always said that you had to pass through, when you died, you had to pass through Atlanta before you went to hell.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we're running out of time, so we're going to put the airplane down on the ground. And Dick and Emil, it's been great having you with us tonight. Thank you so very, very much.
Good night, everybody. Thank you.
And welcome back anytime. You know how to get to us now and listen to our shows. We have a few that we put in the archive. This is 393. Plus, we've done about 80 Thursday shows. They're kind of little mini shows. They last about a half hour to 45 minutes. And we call one of them on one Thursdays. We call them From the Eastern Files. Talk a little bit about history of Eastern. And then on the alternating Thursday at 3 o'clock, these are done at 3 o'clock, we've been playing the big bands. Most of us our age remember the big bands. Harry Jane, Tommy Dorsey, Glenn Miller, and all those. We've been doing those and been having a lot of fun. And what we like to do is during the presentation of the six songs we usually play, between the songs, we tell at that year what Eastern was doing. So it's a lot of fun doing it that way. And so we're talking about Eastern Airlines as much as we can. And it's been great.
My only regret is that when Eastern started up again here a couple of years ago, that they weren't successful, because it sure would have been nice to be able to look up and see an Eastern airplane in the air.
Yeah, sure would have been, but it wasn't to be. Eastern's name is still in the air, but it's attached to another company as well. So, that's our show for tonight, but I'm going to land. You guys haven't heard the landing. I don't know whether it's a DC-8 or a 1011 or just what it is, but we're going to put the airplane on the ground here, and then we're going to turn it back over to our announcer, Jim Hart, if he's still with us. And
I'm right here.
Okay. That's the sound of landings from all Eastern pilots.
Great landing, Jim. Captain, as usual. Thanks to our guests tonight,
Captain Greenway, and Dick Ahrens. You have given us a better understanding of this heroic flight. You, Captain White, and First Officer Roger Holt worked skillfully to save as many on board as were saved. Thank you very much. And Mr. Ahrens, your early reporting of this flight was an event that I'm sure changed your professional career to one of the reporting on aviation safety, which you have proven to be very successful. Thank you, sir. Be sure to tune in again next Monday, December 10, when America's favorite way to fly returns for another flight of adventure. That's our show for tonight, folks. With this, we take a line from the stories from Lake Wobegon, where all the Eastern women are unequaled, all the Eastern flight attendants are above airline standards, all the men are good-looking, and all the Eastern children and Eastern grandchildren are way above average. Until then, we'll say good night, Eastern family. We love you, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern.
Good night.
Good night, Eastern.
Good night,
Eastern. Wings of Man forever.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Let's go, guys. Thanks.